It's Saturday, February 24th. The price of Bitcoin is $9,728, and you want to know what an altcoin is. I'm Josh Humphrey. You're listening to Bottom Shelf Bitcoin. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, the podcast that puts Bitcoin knowledge within everyone's reach. As always, I'm your host, Josh Humphrey, and today we're going to be talking about altcoins. Altcoins, alternative cryptocurrencies you may have seen talked about in the news or social media or Twitter or whatever. And we're going to be talking about what they are, what makes them different from Bitcoin, is there any real value in them or not. Before we go into the market minute, though, I want to tell you about something that happened to me the other day. No lie, I could not have planned this better myself. My kids see me working on this podcast, and my son comes in the other day, and he says, I don't get it. Like, what is Bitcoin? Like, why is it important to people? And we have a series of books by Connor Boyack called the Tuttle Twins series. And so my son and I sat down and we read one of the books called The Creature from Jekyll Island. And it talks about the dangers of the Fed and inflation and bad monetary policies and all these things. And towards the end of the book, it even mentions Bitcoin and other possible alternatives, to the current system. And it literally allows me to say, that's why Bitcoin matters to my son. I mean, I'm telling you, I could not have set this up better myself if I'd planned it. So if you've got kids or you just want more concise versions of some of these quintessential books on liberty and economics and the state and these things, check out the Tuttle Twins book series by Connor Boyack. If you use my special link, bottomshelfbitcoin.com/kidsbook, you can purchase those books and help support the show. Part of your purchase will kick back to the show, and it's not like it costs you anything extra. They're great books. I got the original six. I think they've come out with a seventh one now since I bought the ones that, the original set. So whether you buy that book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, or any other book or combination or all of them or whatever, it helps support the show here. So, I read these books on my own before I even read them to my kids, just, to check them out and make sure they were at their comprehension level. And I think they're really nice because it kind of boils down some of these really, really thicker, heady concepts in some of these books into simpler terms. So great book series. Again, bottomshelfbitcoin.com/kidsbook. Don't forget, I've also got Patreon up and going. There's some bonus content up there for my patrons and all that. So, all right, with all that said, let's get on to the market minute. Okay, market minute. Let's see. Like we said, the price of Bitcoin is $9,728, which puts the price of a penny at 97 cents. Remember, a penny is right in between a Bitcoin and a Satoshi. It's 1/10,000th of a Bitcoin or 10,000 Satoshis. 24-hour volume, $7.2 billion or 752,000 Bitcoins. Market cap is $164 billion. The 200-day moving average is $8,510, which puts our Meyer multiple at 1.14. Transaction fees over the last 24 hours. Now, this is average, not suggested. Average transaction fee in the last 24 hours is 57.86 Satoshis per byte. And over the last 7 days, the average is 36.5 Satoshis per byte. Suggested fees, if you want your transaction in the next block, 106.3 Satoshis per byte. If you're good with the next hour, 101.5 Satoshis per byte. Now, those are pretty close. So, I don't know. If you're if your time preference is that specific that you need it really fast, you might want to up that. I don't know. If you're good with today, 2.4 satoshis per byte. So you see a huge difference in the day versus the hour. And again, Core Fee Helper is a great Twitter account that kind of pushes out those fee estimates. There's also some recently some better estimators, not necessarily than this Twitter account, but just the fee estimations have gotten better and better over time. So let's see what else. I think that's going to be it. CoinDance is a website that I normally use to get the info on BISC and local Bitcoins. There's probably other ways to get that info, but I'm not aware of them right now. So they're doing maintenance right now, and so I can't get that information for you. But I put a link to CoinDance on the show notes so you can go check it out for yourself. They're a pretty cool website. I think that's going to do it for our Market Minute. Okay, so like I said, we're going to be talking about altcoins. And what are they? So altcoins, which is just short for alternative coins, are cryptocurrencies that seek to solve a problem in Bitcoin or solve something that Bitcoin does not address. Some of these are perceived problems. Some of these are legitimate issues. You know, there are some things in Bitcoin that are not, you know, it's not like Satoshi wrote these things down and it was automatically perfect. There's iteration and there's improvements that have been made over the years, and there's still things that need to be done, things that need to be improved. And I, you know, most of the core developers and most of the people that are knowledgeable would acknowledge that there is definitely room for improvement. You know, right now, one of the big things is privacy, because like we've said before, it's only pseudo-anonymous. There are people, there are programs that are really good at linking addresses. And so once any one particular address gets associated to a human or a group or whatever, then it doesn't take a whole lot of work to link every other transaction connected to that. Especially if people are reusing addresses, things like that leave you vulnerable. In the past, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, something like that, a lot of the inspiration for altcoins was in response to, you know, Bitcoin got very popular and consequently the price went up and the transaction fees got a lot more expensive. The time frame for getting your transactions incorporated into a block got slower, and mining also became more difficult, more computing intensive. You know, the hash rate kept going up, the difficulty kept going up, and so the hash rate didn't change, but the difficulty got more and more because people were using better and better equipment. So in order to keep the hash rate time the same, then the difficulty kept going up and up. And so because of that and the rise of ASICs, which is a, you know, like we've said before, it's a very specific machine that is built, purpose built to mine Bitcoin. With the rise of ASICs and the expense of ASICs, then mining kind of became centralized. And so that's another thing that some of these altcoins try and address. Just for clarity's sake, there are both altcoins and what are called forks. Now, most of what we're going to be talking about today are what you would traditionally call altcoins, although at least one of them is a fork. You know, practically speaking, there's not really a lot of difference, but the biggest difference is that what we would call a fork is basically, you know, a lot of the altcoins take the code, some of the code from Bitcoin, and then adjust it for, you know, maybe a different algorithm or a different timing, or they want to incorporate some other things into it. A fork actually copies the blockchain from Bitcoin up to a specific block and then diverges at that point. And so if you have Bitcoin at that block, then you would also theoretically have the other coin as well at the fork. you would have equal amounts at that forking block. This has become called an airdrop because, you know, it's not like we're starting brand new at a new coin and it's got to start getting mined and things like that. They're quote unquote airdropping Bitcoin to people that already have Bitcoin. And so it kind of has this piggybacking network effect using people who are already in Bitcoin to gain momentum into this fork or altcoin, however you want to call it. I don't want to spend a ton of time going into each coin because there's a million altcoins out there and there's no way we'd have time on this show to go into everyone. And realistically, a lot of them kind of do the same thing or they don't do it different enough to even be worth mentioning. There's also a lot of scams out there. And even some of the big ones are kind of scammy. So we're just going to talk about the highlights of the ones that are kind of important or most prominent. All right, so here we go. Let's start with Litecoin. Litecoin was launched in 2011 by Charlie Lee. It is based on the Bitcoin code. It was altered to have blocks every 2.5 minutes instead of every 10 minutes. So the point of that was basically to have faster transactions. They use a different algorithm than Bitcoin for the proof of work verification with the intention that it would be more difficult to mine with the higher end hardware. Keep in mind that when the first ASICs came out, they were purposefully built around the Bitcoin algorithm, the SHA-256 algorithm. And so by using a different algorithm, then these higher end mining equipment could not be used. It's not like someone could just flip over and reuse that on Litecoin like you could with your CPU or your graphics card. Litecoin functions very similarly to Bitcoin, and almost like the Bitcoin testnet. I don't think we actually mentioned testnet last week. Testnet is something on Bitcoin that's basically like a secondary blockchain that functions. Essentially, there's no difference with the main chain except that there are these quote-unquote faucets out there where you can just put an address in and they will just give you testnet Bitcoin. So it's like, hey, here's the exact same thing as Bitcoin, only nobody's actually paying money for it. So it doesn't actually have any value. Because of that, it is used for development of wallets and apps and testing the Bitcoin core code and things like that before it goes live with the new versions. Litecoin, in a lot of ways, is like a Bitcoin testnet with real money, but not near as much as what Bitcoin's valuation is. So Litecoin was important in that it was the first to implement segregated witness, and it was the first to implement Lightning. And so, you know, if I was going to hold an altcoin, I don't have any altcoins. If I was going to hold an altcoin, I might hold Litecoin. I think in the long run, you know, maybe I've heard it compared to like Bitcoin is like digital gold and Litecoin is like silver. Maybe. I'm not saying yes, I'm not saying no. I think it's kind of like that awkward little brother. You know, it will never be Bitcoin, but it may never fully go away either. I think eventually a lot of these altcoins are going to go away because a lot of them will either be shown to be scams or will be shown to not really serve the purpose that they purport to serve, or the problem that they solve will eventually get incorporated or fixed in another way in Bitcoin, and therefore they won't really have a use case scenario anymore, and that money will flow back into Bitcoin. You know, Litecoin may always serve that testnet kind of function. Who knows for sure? No one can predict the future. Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about Ethereum. So, yeah, you can already tell I'm not excited about Ethereum. So technically, Ethereum is actually the platform, and the currency, quote-unquote, would be called Ether, but so many people conflate the terms that they're basically used interchangeably. Ethereum also has this weird thing where they want to be the Turing complete world computer, like this computer that can mimic any other computer, and you can use it to run your application, your DApp, your decentralized app. Ugh, I hate that word DApp. To be honest, though, I hate using the word app for a program on a PC. Just when I think of app, I just think smartphone, but whatever. So you've got this magical world internet computer thing that can run whatever app you want it to, whatever DApp you want it to, and you purchase resources within the computer with a secondary currency inside that called gas. It seems like they're trying to do too much to me. Like, if you're going to be the world computer, be the world computer, or if you want to be a cryptocurrency, be a cryptocurrency. I don't understand why you have to have them merged. I think it's very weird and confusing. But you know, I'm a free market guy. You know, you do your thing, I don't care. My problem with Ethereum and why I don't think you should be invested in it and why I don't think it works really well is, you know, there's a lot of examples, but it kind of comes down to two main areas. There's not enough developers, and, you know, it's centralized, and those are very related issues. So maybe they could kind of be combined into one issue, but, you know, there may be more developers, but there's one very prominent developer, Vitalik Buterin, who was the creator, and he's still the main one working it and deciding where development goes. And he's got all this influence and power on it, and he's also very well known. So if a government ever wanted to come down against Ethereum, he's a prime target. It's not decentralized in their development. I mean, I think they have nodes in some sense. It's different from Bitcoin's nodes. But, you know, all they have to do is find some kind of leverage on Vitalik, and then the governments can start implementing their own agenda against the code of Ethereum. And maybe that's already happened. We don't have a way of knowing whether that's already happened or not. I mean, I think the code may be open source. I don't honestly know, because I have to be honest, before I really understood cryptocurrencies well, I actually had been putting some money in Ethereum. But after kind of what I'm about to talk about, I couldn't do it anymore, and I pulled all my money out. I didn't even try and time the price better. I just dumped it. Because the other side is they only have a few developers, and I said that already, but kind of the problem is there's this saying in computer science, and I may have said this before, but with enough eyes, all bugs are shallow. And that means basically the more people you have reviewing code, the more likely they are to find any kind of bugs before they make it to the final production. And any bugs that do make it to the final production are likely not to be these big critical flaws. And Ethereum does not have enough eyes for the bugs to be shallow, basically. They have this history of critical errors, whether in Ethereum itself or in associated wallets and apps. And you can go back and look at the Parity wallet, had issues where, you know, the equivalent of $32 million, I think it was at the time, got just sent out into nothing, because they have these smart contracts that are supposed to be able to execute when someone acknowledges that their part of the contract is done, then the smart contract executes and people get paid, and that's all well and good, but the code was shoddy and someone went in there and figured out they could put in basically a suicide command to the program, and it killed everyone who'd ever used that library's code. And it just killed all of the addresses associated with any contract on that system, and it just killed a ton of people's money. And that's not the first time that something similar to that has happened. And every time this happens, then they just go, well, maybe we should just perform a hard fork. I mean, it's happened several times. And then Vitalik and a few people, if they lose money and it's important enough to them, then they go, well, we'll just do a hard fork. And they back up a few blocks before it happened and they fork off the chain. And then they say, oh, well, now this is the new Ethereum. And there's huge implications here. One is that someone shouldn't have that much power. If they have that much power, then it's not censorship resistance. It's not decentralized and it can be exploited anytime you want. The other issue is that if they're going to fork every time they disagree with what happened and reality doesn't turn out the way they hoped, then you have no guarantee if there's something like in Bitcoin, we have this 21 million limit that so many people believe in and are trusting in. And because Bitcoin is so decentralized, if someone decided, I mean, I guess it's potentially possible that later on down the line, people could say, hey, we're changing and we're getting rid of the 21 million coin limit. But it would be a tooth and nail fight against basically every node. And you would have to convince enough nodes to disagree with the 21 million coin limit. But in Ethereum, because there's so few development people working on this, there's only a few people you would have to convince, and clearly they've shown that they're willing to do it. They're willing to make these huge splits over a few people losing money. Even if there's a lot of people losing money, I mean, still, like, the whole point is, I mean, not the whole point, but a big point of cryptocurrency is to have sound money policies that can't be exploited and jerked around. And Ethereum has shown that they don't care. They don't mind jerking it around. Also, there's a bunch of other ICOs, which is initial coin offerings. Think of it like an IPO in traditional stocks where you have an initial public offering. An initial coin offering is basically like a pre-sale on altcoins that haven't actually been created yet, which I think is always a risky thing. Most ICOs are scams, you know, and ICOs are basically ways or have been traditionally, you know, somebody will put out a white paper and do an ICO and get a bunch of ether and then no coin ever shows up, or they're in production and working on it and putting out updates about working on it for years and it never really happens, or when it does happen, it's terrible. There's also these ERC-20 tokens, which is a smart contract based on Ethereum. And there's a bunch of projects and a bunch of altcoins that are based on those. And so if they're built on top of Ethereum, then fundamentally they have all these same problems that Ethereum has. And when something fatal goes wrong in Ethereum, like where are those guys going to be if they're built on top of it? Okay, so real quick, my wife reminded me that I cannot forget the Dogecoin. And so Doge, just like the meme with Shiba Inu, you know, such wow. Doge started out as a joke when all these other altcoins started showing up. Someone made a Dogecoin, and it really was a joke. And then people started mining it and people started buying it, and the guy was like, no guys, wait, stop, this was a joke. And they kept doing it. So there's still people mining and trading Doge. I think it trades for less than pennies, but I mean, it's still out there, so people are still mining it. I don't know why, but it's hilarious, and it's Doge is great. So it's literally like, it's, you know, if Litecoin is Bitcoin's younger brother, Doge is like his little pet dog. It's still there. I don't know, whatever. So yeah, my wife reminded me to talk about Doge, so thank her for bringing some lightheartedness after ragging on Ethereum. So okay, let's move on to Monero. Monero is a privacy-minded altcoin. It I believe Monero still used Bitcoin's basic code to start with. It uses ring signatures to hide addresses involved in transactions. It's kind of hard to explain and for you to understand in an audio format, so I'm just going to put a link in the show notes so you can go read about ring signatures and how that works on a privacy setting. After people kind of realized that Bitcoin was not anonymous, some of these other altcoins started up. And, you know, one of the big markets for Bitcoin in the early days was called the Silk Road. And, you know, Silk Road got a bad rap. It was a market for anything, but it could not be it could not be violent. So, you know, you couldn't do murder for hire. There were no illicit things involving children, but there were drugs. I'm sure there was prostitution and stuff like that on it, but it was all voluntary. So I'm not glorifying those things. I'm just saying free market, voluntary exchange, whatever. You know, go read up on Ross Ulbricht and how the government came down on him and made an example of him. He is serving 2 life sentences for running a website. It's just not even, it's not even begin to be proportional in punishment for the crime, and crime in quotation marks even. The trial was bogus. Basically, every FBI agent that was involved in the sting has been investigated, if not convicted, for corruption after the fact. And still, they've got a man sitting and serving double life sentence for running a website. So, why do I say all that? After the Silk Road was busted, you know, people realized, okay, like, we can't totally use Bitcoin and be anonymous completely. So Monero is an altcoin, like I said, that's focused on privacy, and it's probably used the most for these things that are, you know, morally gray or bad. I don't know that anyone uses Monero for other things other than maybe trading. But, you know, that's censorship resistance, right? To do things that those who would censor you frown on. Okay, there's another one called Zcash, and it actually does not follow the Bitcoin base code. It uses ZK Snarks as a technology to, as a protocol for a trustless transaction. I'm going to be honest, it's hard for me to kind of wrap my mind around the whole Zcash thing and how it works. So I'll leave links in the show notes. Go check those out. Because it is understandable. It's just, it's difficult to explain. And really, I would probably be just like reading you the paper, which is not why you come here. So it's a privacy-minded coin. Monero and Zcash are both probably the 2 biggest ones working on the privacy issue right now. And so I think they both have value in that. I don't hold either one of those, but, you know, if I was going to hold altcoins, I'd probably hold, like I said, Litecoin and maybe some Monero just for the thrills of saying that, oh, you've got a sneaky evil coin or whatever. I don't know. Okay, moving on. Let's talk about Ripple. Ripple is probably one you've seen on CNBC Fast Money, and it's garbage. It's not actually a cryptocurrency. It's not censorship resistant. It's not decentralized. You can't buy anything with it. It's just, it was created a partnership, I think, between R3 and Ripple Labs, and 100% of it was pre-mined, which means, you know, nobody is there. It's not like this decentralized network of miners who are verifying the network and then earning coins for that. Like, all of it's been pre-mined. And then 20% of it was given to the creators. And then 80% was given to Ripple Labs, which is owned by the creators who got the original 20%. And then Ripple Labs sold off, you know, some of it, I guess, or whatever, or is selling it off or giving it in partnerships to their banking buddies or whatever. It's this weird thing, like, it was created to sell to people who don't understand cryptocurrency and don't understand why you need it to be censorship resistant or why you need it to have a blockchain or what's the use of it, et cetera, et cetera. It was one of those ones that came up when Bitcoin started getting big in the fall, or, you know, maybe the last year. I will say this, big banking people and financial people love it, which is enough for me to run the other direction. IOTA, IOTA is another one kind of in a similar vein. Just run away from IOTA. It's some weird kind of corporate coin tangled mess. There have been alleged partnerships with Microsoft, which may or may not actually be a partnership. You know, again, this is another one that you can't use for anything. And I will grant you that the market for actually spending Bitcoin has gone down a lot. You know, it did expand, which helped increase the price. But then when the network got sluggish and everyone was believing that the price was just going to keep going up, like, why would you spend something today that's going to be worth more tomorrow? And so a lot of people backed off accepting it on merchants, but you can still buy stuff with Bitcoin. What can you do with Ripple or IOTA? Nothing. You can't buy anything with them. You can just trade them back and forth. Anyway, stay away from those two, or anything else that you can't actually buy anything with. If there are no merchants accepting it, then, you know, it's, you know, I guess you could argue a store of value, but even that doesn't even make sense for those two. Okay, let's talk about Dash. So Dash attempts to solve quote unquote governance. And this is something you will see a lot, is this idea of governance. It'll kind of pop up and then go away and then pop up again. Like, oh, we need governance in Bitcoin. No, we don't. You know, consensus among nodes is governance, and a open source development process that allows anybody to go in and write code, that's governance. Dash comes from, the term Dash comes from digital cash, dcash, digital cash, Dash. You know, it's a nice idea. They want to be able to pay developers instead of developers working freelance. We talked last week about how, yes, there are developers that work on their spare time voluntarily on Bitcoin, but there's also developers who work for other companies, and that's their job, is to develop Bitcoin, or maybe just part of their job, whatever. And so Dash has this nice idea, hey, we're going to pay developers. And so you have kind of this, it's not super complicated, system where people who hold significant amounts of Dash, I don't remember what it is anymore, but if you hold a significant amount of Dash, you can lock that amount into what's called a masternode. And that proves that you are invested in the system. And so, you know, governance encapsulates for them what development issues are going to be addressed and how the development money is spent on what projects, etc. And so masternodes get a vote in that process of governance. And so in order to fund all of this, when miners mine Dash, they don't get all of that base reward. So that mining reward is split between the miners, the masternodes, and the development team. And it's a nice idea, in one sense, to pay your developers. But again, then it's like, if you have this known group of people who are paid, is it really censorship resistant? Is it really decentralized? I mean, you have to have both nodes be the network itself needs to be decentralized, but development also needs to be decentralized, as we've talked about on this show. I don't know, maybe some people don't believe that, but to me, if your development team is known and not decentralized, then it doesn't take much to get leverage on any one person and exert influence on the code. And again, if you are paying your developers, if you're not really decentralized and censorship resistant, how are you different than PayPal? Like, why do you need a blockchain for this? I just don't see the need for it, other than you say we need to get off of fiat currency. And that's all well and good, but the whole issue with that is, if your goal is to get off of US dollars or other national fiat currencies, you have to believe that at some point they're going to fight back. They're not just going to roll over. And I'm not saying that maybe there's going to come a day when government officials come kick down your door with automatic weapons and say, you know, hand me over your treasure or whatever. Maybe it'll come to that. I don't know the future, but I like to think that, you know, Bitcoin development is going to proceed at a quick enough rate that by the time they figure out what's happening, they really can't do that. You know, like I said, I don't know the future. Maybe that day will come. I'd like to think not. But with Dash, I just go, I don't know. To me, that's too centralized, and you're paying your development team all from one place. So what makes you different or faster or better than PayPal? Now, I know they do have an option for private transactions that you can kind of pay an extra fee on top to the network and do some privacy there, which is all well and good. But again, privacy transactions only go so far when your development team isn't, you know, censorship resistant, isn't diversified. So if you're out there and you know more about Dash than I do, I'm by no means an expert on this. I'm just telling you what I do know and how I see it from that standpoint. Maybe I'm missing something. Tell me if I'm wrong. Okay. Now we got to talk about Bcash, I guess. I hate talking about Bcash. Bcash is short for Bitcoin Cash. And the problem is, or part of the issue is, there are both technical and political issues that I take with Bitcoin Cash. But the Bitcoin Cash movement has intertwined those technical and political issues so much that it's difficult to extract them. And I would love to just focus on the technical issues and say, you know, I don't care if you do what you do, but this is why I see that it's not really what you say it is. And the problem is, so much of what Bitcoin Cash is about is a political movement within the Bitcoin world. So Bitcoin Cash is a fork off of Bitcoin at a specific block, and it was basically created as a reaction to SegWit. These were the guys who kept championing the big block size, and they wanted to change the block size from 1 megabyte to 2, or they wanted to just increase the block size to make transactions faster and cheaper again. And that's okay, you know what, do your own fork. But the problem is that at the same time that they did that, then one, they called their coin Bitcoin Cash, and, you know, I don't care about that in itself, but they get super offended when you use the term Bcash. People only use the word Bcash because Bcash is shorter to say. It's easier to say. They get super offended by that, and you go, why do they get super offended? And it's because, you know, they've used some big players, big money, big personalities with influence and deception, and piggybacked off of the Bitcoin network, and they're trying to confuse and deceive people and take the title of the real Bitcoin. And that's what frustrates people about Bcash. There have been several attempts to kind of co-opt the name and the network, and they specifically chose the same SHA-256 hashing algorithm. And that was done intentionally to try and pull miners away from Bitcoin. You know, there's a lot more. I could do a whole episode of content on Bcash, but I don't really want to dignify that. And part of that's because I hate the political drama side of it. It's there, it exists, I can't ignore it completely, but I feel like I'm wasting time on show, and I don't like ad hominem attacks. I like sticking to the technical reasons why something is not Bitcoin. And so it's very difficult with Bcash. The other thing is that with the development of SegWit and the adoption of SegWit by these big companies now, you know, this last week, both Bitfinex and Coinbase announced that they're rolling out SegWit, which is huge. It's good. These big companies have also been incorporating batching into their processes. and Lightning, which we will be talking about in the near future. I don't know if we're going to do it the next episode, but shortly we're going to be talking about the Lightning Network and how that's helping. And, you know, we keep seeing these transaction fees and transaction wait times go down and down and down. And Bcash is basically becoming irrelevant. You know, if you really want technical arguments against Bcash, big blocks, and this goes for any other big block fork, right? Having bigger blocks than what is there right now encourages sloppy code writing. There have been groups and companies that when you look at are just not managing their code, and they're adding like all this extra garbage into the transaction data, and then it's causing users to have huge transaction fees and all this stuff. And so even at 1 megabyte blocks, you know, back in the day, nobody thought we'd be, I'm not going to say nobody thought we'd ever be filling up 1 megabyte blocks, but they weren't even filling up 1 megabyte blocks at one point. And then it got all the way to having these huge wait times, and now we're back to, you know, very small transaction fees and very low wait times. And that's because the users have put pressure back on Coinbase and Bitfinex and these other companies to, you know, manage their code and use these other technologies. And if you jump the block size up again, there's no incentive to manage your code and to write clean, concise code, manage your transactions in a way that makes sense and is good for the system. We're back to having these large, big data transactions. And when you do that, the problem is you have made running a node at your house that much more difficult. The blockchain is huge amounts of data. It's a bunch of bandwidth having to pull down and validate these blocks. It prices people out of running their own node. And when you do that, you lose centralization. And, you know, the people, you can listen to the people who are for it, and they're fine with people keeping their coins on Coinbase. They're fine with, you know, they say, oh, so many people just keep their coins in Coinbase right now as it is. That's fine. We can just do similar things and have these big corporations that are running nodes. Like, what? If you're doing that, and then you're defeating the whole, like, I don't trust a third party thing. And then we're back to PayPal. Like, PayPal has a purpose. PayPal has a good product. You know, my issue with PayPal is that it's run on fiat currency and that the government can audit it. And, you know, if you're doing too much business on PayPal, then they're going to tax you for it. I'm not telling you to avoid taxes. I'm just saying it's not censorship resistant at that point, you know? And so there's the technical argument, is that it loses centralization if it becomes big and becomes difficult for average users to run their own nodes. Okay, so I think that's going to do it. If you guys want to know more about any particular altcoin, or you just want to interact with me, hit me up on Twitter at BottomShelfBTC. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or whatever other podcast player you use so you don't miss an episode. Share these episodes with your friends and your families and your enemies. Don't forget, you can support the show with fiat through Patreon. Like I said, I've got some stuff up on there, exclusive content there, and it's just going to keep rolling out. Or by buying Tuttle Twins books through my link with bottomshelfbitcoin.com/kidsbook, KIDSBOOK. Or if you want to support me with Bitcoin, you can use a Paynim enabled wallet through my donation link on bottomshelfbitcoin.com/donate. All right, that's going to do it for today. Come back next week. We are going to be talking about the scaling debate. This is the debate, you know, with the block size and everything that led to SegWit and all that. So, yeah, come back and listen. That's going to be a good episode. All right, for Bottom Shelf Bitcoin, I'm Josh Humphrey. Thanks for listening.